the limelight.
Biden's foreign policy so far is largely made up of failures to achieve his stated goals and failures to overturn the worst policies that he inherited from Trump. In some cases, Biden has not even made the effort to overturn them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Daniel Larrison Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Biden's Foreign Policy Failures. Stay tuned, please, for the details. Joe Biden's foreign policy record as president in his first 6 months has been as bad as his non-interventionist and anti-war critics feared it would be. On almost every other front, Biden has not only failed to undo some of his predecessor's worst and most destructive policies, but in many cases, he has entrenched and reinforced them. If Trump imposed maximum pressure sanctions on another country, Biden has kept all those sanctions in place. Even on those few issues where Biden seemed willing to make meaningful changes to Trump's policies for the better, such as ending U.S. support for the war on Yemen, Biden has offered either lip service or he has moved so slowly that it is difficult to see any change at all. No one expected Biden to oversee a radical overhaul of the foreign policy status quo that he has defended for decades, but even on his own terms, he has failed to deliver. Biden claimed that he would treat Saudi Arabia regime as a pariah, but he has done nothing of the sort. While it was never likely that the U.S. would shun the Saudis entirely, Biden had given his supporters reason to expect that there would be significant changes to their relationship. The recent visit of the Crown Prince's brother and Saudi Deputy Defense Minister Khalid bin Salman to Washington, where he met with almost every top official in the administration, confirmed that this was a vain hope. The U.S. continues to support the Saudi coalition war on Yemen, and the administration has not been forthcoming at all about what military assistance the U.S. has stopped providing to the Saudis and their allies. Trump-era weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates have been greenlit after briefly being put on hold. Biden's Department of Justice risibly claims that the UAE's history of using U.S.-made weapons to commit war crimes and its pattern of handing off some of these weapons to their proxies have no bearing on what they will do with such weapons in the future. The president was happy to get credit for declaring an end to U.S. support for, as they say, offensive operations in Yemen. But the most significant offensive operation that the coalition has been carrying out for the last 6 years, the killing, blockade imposed on the country, continues with at least tacit U.S. backing. Yemen remains the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and U.S. clients continue to starve the people of Yemen. Biden has done almost nothing to rein in those clients. As long as the U.S. regime continues to arm and assist these regimes, Americans remain complicit in their crimes. The economic wars that the United States regime has been waging against Venezuela, Iran, Syria, and North Korea have not ended, and neither have their deleterious effects on tens of millions of people. Whether it is because of electoral considerations or some other goal, Biden remains committed to Trump's policy of regime change in Venezuela. And administration officials like to tell the press that he is in no rush to lift the devastating sanctions that have contributed to the humanitarian catastrophe there. Likewise, Biden's response to protests in Cuba has been to keep all Trump-era restrictions in place, including harmful limits on remittances, and to add on additional pointless sanctions on top officials. Inflicting collective economic punishment on entire countries remains one of the cornerstones of the current bipartisan foreign policy consensus. Biden moved too slowly to rejoin the nuclear deal with Iran, and more than halfway through 2021, the U.S. is still not a party to the agreement that Trump reneged on. It remains to be seen if the negotiations will collapse, but Biden's unwillingness to offer any sanctions relief upfront may very well have doomed the effort from the beginning. In another continuation of Trump's policies, Biden has ordered unauthorized attacks on anti-terrorist resistance groups in Iraq and Syria. Instead of getting all U.S. troops out of Iraq, Biden is choosing simply to relabel them as advisors so that he can take credit for ending the presence of combat forces in the country. Most of the U.S. military presence will remain for some unspecified amount of time. Biden's record over the last 6 months has included several other serious errors, including enabling and rewarding the Zionist regime's indiscriminate attacks in Gaza, and the decision to leave Trump's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. These are all cases of catering to U.S. regime, so it is not surprising that Biden did these things, but they still deserve to be condemned. For all of the Biden administration's talk of putting human rights at the center of their foreign policy, their actions tell a very different, familiar story of supporting abusive clients no matter what they do. Biden's foreign policy so far is largely made up of failures to achieve his stated goals and failures to overturn the worst policies that he inherited from Trump. In some cases, Biden has not even made the effort to overturn them. The Biden administration likes to use the phrase, "America is back," as its foreign policy motto. Judging from Biden's first 6 months, this just means that America is back to more of the same destructive and inhumane policies that we have had for decades.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تحبس الدعاء اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تنزل البلاء اللهم اغفر لي كل ذنب أذنبته وكل خطية أخطأتها اللهم إني أتقرب إليك بذكرك وأستشفع بك إلى نفسك.
Brothers and sisters, the phrase under discussion was the part where Imam عليه السلام says, اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تحبس الدعاء. Oh Allah, forgive me the sins which hold back supplication. In order to talk about this phrase more, we had a quick look at Imam Sajjad alayhi salam's tradition, in which Imam alayhi salam considers seven sins which prevent the acceptance of supplications by Almighty. The first was bad intentions, and the second, hidden vices. And today, we will talk about mistrust as one of the hidden vices that prevent the acceptance of prayers. So the word mistrust can have different implications and connotations, but in our case, it means being suspicious of Allah or His friends and the Muslims. And this is an obscene, although hidden sin, which is recorded in the Book of Deeds. And it is accounted for on the Day of Resurrection and chastised severely, as the traditions suggest. Of course, there is one exception to this, and the exception is the one who can repent in this world. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْضَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمًا. O you who believe, avoid suspicion as much as possible, for suspicion, in some cases, is a sin. In this regard, we have a rather long tradition from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He starts saying, "Wallahi alladhi la ilaha illahu, ma u'tiya mu'minun khayra ad-dunya wal-akhirah illa bihusni dhannihi billah wa raja'ihi lah. I swear by God, who has no partners, that no good of this world or hereafter has been granted to any believer, except due to his good opinion about God, his good behavior, وحسني خلقه والكفي عن اغتياب المؤمنين, and his avoidance of gossiping and slandering. والله الذي لا إله إلا هو لا يعذب الله مؤمنا بعد التوبة والاستغفار إلا بسوء ظنه بالله وتقصير من رجائه لله وسوء خلقه واغتيابه المؤمنين. And I swear by God, who has no partners, that God will not punish anyone after repentance and seeking forgiveness, except due to his bad opinion about God, insufficient hope in God, bad behavior and gossiping about believers.
Oh, first of the foremost, oh, last existence after the last. Oh Allah, forgive me my such sins which tear away my safeguards. Oh Allah, forgive me my such sins as would bring down calamity. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins that would change your favor. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins that would hinder my supplications. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins which descend misfortunes. Oh Allah, forgive my sins that suppress hope. Oh Allah, forgive every sin that I have committed and every error that I have earned. Oh Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf, and I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. O Allah, I ask you, begging submissively, humbly and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances.
Then the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam continues, لا يحسن ظن عبد مؤمن بالله إلا كان الله عند ظن عبده المؤمن. I swear by God who has no partners that there are no believers who have a good opinion about God and receive anything less than what they expect from Him. لأن الله كريم بيده الخيرات يستحي أن يكون عبده المؤمن قد أحسن به الظن والرجاء ثم يخلف ظنه ورجاء. This is so since God is benevolent and has authority over all that is good, and is ashamed if one of his servants have a good opinion about him and he acts on the contrary. And at the end, the Prophet says, فَأَحْسِنُوا بِاللَّهِ ظَنَّ وَارْغَبُوا إِلَيْهِ. Therefore have a good opinion about God and be inclined to him. So a believer who has the virtues of belief, good morality, behavior, should be hopeful of Almighty Allah's mercy and avoid any doubts about Him. These doubts, dear listeners, will originate in the mind and heart of the Muslims and believers. What the evildoers and what specifically Satan is looking forward to find. Because insufficient hope in God will turn men and women, all human beings, into the slaves of Satan. Because whether you have lots of good deeds or you have lots of wrongdoings, insufficient hope in God means not believing in Him. It means mistrust. And this means your prayers will not be accepted, and as a result, you will be away from the station of the Almighty Allah's mercy. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The light.
Last year, a powerful explosion in Beirut turned life around for thousands of Lebanese. Now, a number of people have decided to build a monument in honor of the victims of the terrible accident. 27 individuals and organizations have pooled their efforts to build a giant 25-meter sculpture at a site of last August's explosion. The artwork is called Gesture and is made out of reclaimed metal debris. It looks like it's handing a flower to the city of Beirut. When completed, Gesture will also have a water and light installation. The project was conceived and designed by Nadim Karam, one of Lebanon's most celebrated artists.
Are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not, based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this, how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. hypothetical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8th Tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. Their quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. There is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world known as Van Gogh Live. The experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to
COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. And of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses, with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors. Conservation measures have managed to bring the world's most endangered cat back from the brink of extinction. In 2002, there were less than 100 Iberian lynx left in the wild. The situation prompted officials in Spain and Portugal to save the animal through a captive breeding program. They also tried hard to fight poaching and reintroduce rabbits, the cat's major prey, into the wild. By the end of 2020, there were over 1,100 Iberian lynx living in the two countries, most of them in Spain's southern region of Andalusia.
The main cause of death for wildlife, certainly in the natural environment, is related to human activities, roadkill, poaching, unwanted encounters. So the less interaction they have with humans, the better.
Despite the successful measures, the International Union for Conservation of Nature still lists the animal as endangered. It's estimated that the species will be out of danger only when its population surpasses 3,000. Urban development, hunting, and roadkill are the major reasons of death for wild lynxes these days. Brazilians have come up with a creative idea to combat population, that is pollution and global warming, repopulating mangroves. The project is aimed at reforesting an area equal to 75 football fields in Guanabara Bay. Organizers hope to make the biggest mangrove garden in the country. Mangroves, which usually grow in tropical regions, are essential to maintaining water quality and clarity. They filter and trap sediments, heavy metals, and other pollutants. Mangrove forests are also able to store 3 to 4 times more carbon than other forests.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
A mesmerizing hot air balloon festival has got on the way in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The sky was littered with nearly 100 beautifully colored hot air balloons in different shapes, captivating every viewer. The awe-inspiring event brought together COVID-wary citizens to experience joy and jubilation amid health restrictions. Pleasant weather made the experience all the more enjoyable. The 38th annual New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning is likely the largest outdoor entertainment event in the tri-state area since the pandemic began.
Nostalgia is in the air in Paris as the streets of the city are enlivened, that is, with old vehicles. The French capital has hosted an annual parade called Summer Crossing of Paris. It brought together over 700 vintage cars, motorbikes, buses, and tractors from all over Europe. The route started from a Vincennes castle east of Paris and ended in the southwest of the city. Drivers crossed the iconic monuments such as the Eiffel Tower and the Arc de Triomphe.
It is extraordinary because the automobile industry heritage and the Parisian architectural heritage, which is obviously absolutely fabulous, echo each other. We are driving through all of Paris's most beautiful squares.
The 14th version of the event drew hundreds of enthusiastic visitors from across France. People were asked to wear masks and keep social distancing because of COVID-19. Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Palau. Palazzo Farnese is one of the most famous palaces in Rome and is being used as the French embassy. However, some of the rooms there are not open to the public. Now, an artist has come up with a creative way to show the historic building to everyone. An Italian artist known as JR has created a mural art installation on the French diplomatic mission in Rome. The artwork is equivalent to a virtual hole and shows what the building would look like if there were no outside walls. JR has conducted similar dazzling projects on other buildings, including a mural in the city of Florence, providing people with a sneak view of architectural masterpieces.
There is a famous quote, one should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity. A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But, he says, his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge. Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Liriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Liriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Liriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Loriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year.
On Thursday, Israel attained observer status at the African Union after nearly 20 years of lobbying. Making the move official, Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Burundi, and Chad presented his credentials to Moussa Faki Mohamed, the chairman of the African Union Commission, at the bloc's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
But for African countries, Palestine is now no longer a priority. Unfortunately, for some Arab countries that have turned their back to Palestine. This is the same.
The move was met with harsh criticism from Palestinian resistance groups and several African nations. In a letter to the chairperson of the African Union, head of Hamas political wing Ismail Haniyeh said the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union toward the Palestinian cause. South Africa also fiercely objected to the move by the Union. It said the AU Commission made the decision unilaterally without consulting its members.
Now, none of the member states were officially consulted, except those that are probably pro-Israeli. The pro-Israeli ones are well known. It's Kenya, it's Tanzania, it's Rwanda, Togo, Cameroon. These are the countries that are backing this move.
The South African Foreign Ministry has called the AU's move, quote, incomprehensible and inexplicable. The South African government said the African Union's decision is even more shocking in a year in which oppressed people of Palestine were hounded by destructive bombardments and continued illegal settlements of the land. It was referring to Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May that killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children. The war broke out after the regime's decision to evict several Palestinian families from their homes in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, South Africa has been preceded by Algeria, and in Algeria a week ago was up in arms at this decision without having been consulted, and said it was contrary to the charter of the African Union, that the charter does not allow apartheid states, a state that practices racism as its official policy, to be part of as an observer, and that commits atrocities against an occupied population. And today, Namibia has joined South Africa.
Israel previously held observer status in the predecessor organization of African Unity until 2002, when the organization was disbanded and replaced by the AU. Pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union. Besides, the United States, Israel's closest ally, also operates in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism there. However, local sources say civilians have been the main victims of the attacks conducted by U.S. forces.
In fact, even in on the southern border of Syria, in the Quneitra region, Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, who are a terrorist organization fighting against the Syrian government, have been aided both militarily, financially, logistically by Israel. So, I mean, this is, of course, just diplomatic talk.
That underlines the risk for Africa to have a possible Israeli military presence, as the Israeli regime is already facing a probe over war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation? The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many. And both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that one key lesson for future administrations to learn from the experience gained during the tenure of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani is that there is no benefit in putting one's trust in the West. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the members of President Rouhani's administration. He said it was manifested during the tenure of this administration that nothing can be gained from putting one's trust in the West. The leader added that domestic programs should in no way be tied to Western states under any circumstances due to the proven failure of such an approach.
Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's regional role have nothing to do with the original JCPOA or United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. They are simply irrelevant. And so to the extent that the United States continues to attempt to utilize maximum pressure to bring in irrelevant issues such as ballistic missiles and Iran's regional role, I believe that we will very soon reach this impasse and that the Raisi administration will bring an end to this charade in Vienna.
Making a reference to the ongoing talks in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ayatollah Khamenei acknowledged that endeavors made by Iranian diplomats, saying, however, that Americans insisted on their hostile stance against Iran and did not move even one step forward during the talks. The leader denounced the U.S. attempts to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues. He said by adding such a clause, the Americans are seeking to gain an excuse for further meddlesome acts regarding Iran's missile program and regional issues.
If the talks in Vienna aren't already at an impasse, I believe that this is where we're going to be heading very soon if the United States continues to refuse to return to its responsibilities and its obligations under the agreement and instead attempts to utilize the illegal terrorist sanctions and maximum pressure campaign of the Trump regime in Vienna to acquire leverage over Iran in the negotiations, specifically regarding issues that have nothing to do with the JCPOA.
Ayatollah Khamenei drew attention to the fact that the U.S. has refused to provide Iran with a guarantee that it will not violate its commitments again. He noted that Washington will not shy away from violating its contractual commitments in the same manner that it did in 2018, a move that was completely costless for them. 6 rounds of negotiations have been held so far in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the Iran nuclear deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the JCPOA. 3 years ago, the U.S., under former President Donald Trump, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and branded what it called the Maximum Pressure Campaign against Iran. Now President Joe Biden, who was the Vice President of the United States when the deal was inked, has promised to re-enter the JCPOA and abandon Trump's failed Maximum Pressure Campaign.
Iran's position on the JCPOA and international law has been clear and consistent since the signing of the JCPOA in 2015. And so as such, I don't believe that an incoming Raisi administration or frankly any new incoming Iranian presidential administration would handle the current talks and negotiations any differently.
But so far, he's practically followed footsteps of his predecessor. President-elect Ibrahim Raisi will be officially sworn in on August 5th. Raisi won the June 18 presidential election in a landslide victory, garnering over 18 million votes. It's widely believed the foreign policy in Iran has a well-established and large-scale framework. When it comes to the issue of the Vienna talks, Iran's policies are not going to change. Therefore, no fundamental changes are expected in the negotiation process under the next administration. However, analysts believe the next administration needs to bolster the national position of Iran to successfully counter the bullying stance of the U.S. and its allies.
Tunisia is facing its worst crisis in a decade after President Kais Saied ousted the government of Prime Minister Hicham Mechichi and suspended parliament with help of the army. Saied has announced that he would assume executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister. This is seen as the biggest challenge yet to Tunisia's democratic system. Kais Saied has also imposed a nighttime curfew across the country to prevent unrest and violence. Parliament Speaker Rachid Ghannouchi, who heads Ennahda Party, has condemned Saied's decision as an assault on Tunisia's democracy.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise Ennahda, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution.
Ennahda has played an important role in successive coalition governments. Ghannouchi has urged his supporters to take to the streets to show their anger at the president's decision. Tunisia has witnessed mass protests in several cities across the country against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the dismal state of the economy.
Well, I guess Tunisia is going through turmoil and many problems, internal problems and, of course, foreign problems, because of the relationship between, for example, Ennahda and Saied with the French and with the Emirates and all these things.
The president has described his actions as constitutional and said Article 80 of the Constitution gave him power to dismiss the government, appoint a temporary administration, freeze parliament, and lift the immunity of its members.
Some have talked yesterday about a coup. I don't know in which law or political sciences school they studied. How can a coup be based on the Constitution? This is an implementation of the constitutional script. Article 80 of the Constitution gave the President of the Republic the right to take the procedures he sees necessary in the face of an imminent danger.
Tunisia witnessed a successful revolution back in 2011. Back then, Tunisians ousted the country's former Western-backed ruler, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, following mass protests. Many believe the revolution failed to deliver prosperity or good governance.
And I guess the issue is very, very deep and profound, because there's a great conflict between these people in the government, who have made a kind of collaboration between the secularists and the Ennahda movement. Ennahda movement, through its relation with the Turks and Bin Said with the Emirates and the French and the NATO, there is a problem.
President Said is reported to have requested critical financial assistance from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt in order to stave off the crisis. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are seen as opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood. Ennahda, which is an important force in Tunisia's political landscape, is said to have close ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. In recent years, Ennahda has sought to distance itself from the Brotherhood. Regional allies of Ennahda, including Turkey and Qatar, have sharply criticized President Said's moves.
What will do, what will make a probably a possible exit from this crisis, is that to go all of them to a new constitution that would distribute the legitimacies and the privileges of the institutions, the constitutional institutions, into a new relationship that depends on the election, on the people, to go to a new referendum about the situation in Tunisia. But I guess the situation in Tunisia is going to really deteriorate and accelerate more in a dangerous manner.
Opponents of President Said have likened him to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who deposed the Brotherhood's elected former president, Mohamed Morsi, and banned the group in 2013.
IRIB English Radio.